And well, Glenn Lowry here at Brown University and at bloggingheads.tv, The Glenn Show, joined by John McWhorter of Columbia University, Time Magazine, and other outlets. We are here talking the morning after the grand jury in Ferguson, Missouri, made public its decision to issue no indictments against Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of the unarmed African-American teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. John, you had a piece in the online edition of Time. It seemed to have been written almost within minutes of the jury's verdict coming public. Why don't you tell us a little bit about this? And that's what we're going to be talking about. We, the self-declared black guys at bloggingheads.tv, are going to deal with the Ferguson fallout.
Yeah, I'm beginning to feel my age. It's getting harder to bang those things out so fast. This stuff just, they want it right away. But what I said in the piece is something where, and you and I have turned out to agree, because we've been kind of murmuring this at each other over the past couple weeks, and you have a very similar piece coming in the Boston Review, which is that what happened to Michael Brown is a tragedy, and there are all kinds of things that can be said about Darren Wilson firing, whether or not he would have fired that gun if Michael Brown had been white, what kind of police forces, occupying forces do we have. But I think that the particular facts in Ferguson, how that played out, are such that the idea that this one is the one that should be used as the grand iconic rallying cry about police brutality is flawed, because unfortunately, of course, Michael Brown did not deserve to die. It was a hideous tragedy. But this is something different from what happened to, say, Amadou Diallo in New York, where he was shot 41 times for pulling out a wallet that officers thought was a gun. Trayvon Martin, who is detained by a self-inflated pretend policeman and ends up getting shot to death. Various cases that I could enumerate. This one is someone who had committed a crime, and we now know the details from last night. Darren Wilson stopped him because he fit the description, a very specific description. And then Michael Brown resisted being detained. And now after that, terrible things happened. There's an escalation. And we now know that Michael Brown was coming back at Wilson. Now, I assume that he was coming back at him in surrender. I can't see why somebody would run towards somebody with a gun. That sounds insane. But still, Wilson apparently thought that more was coming and fired. Now, these are hideous events, but it's all rather ambiguous. And the idea that that's a story of the devaluation of the black body, as academics are putting it, doesn't work. The nation is not going to rally around something so ambiguous. And so what worries me is that this case is being treated as if it's it, as if it's a matter of this poor boy being shot in cold blood, when a whole lot more was going on. And you agree, don't you?
I certainly agree with that. That is somehow the connecting tissue of this essay that I'm still working on, or that's still in the process. It's going to be the anchor piece for a symposium in the Boston Review's January-February edition, 2015. So comments will be solicited from people. I'll make a response to those comments. So this is still in the process. But, yeah, I mean, I want to get to a number of the points that you raised, but just to sketch out the nature of this area of agreement between the two of us, which will not be universally accepted, is this idea that the case is not a good one around which to construct the overall necessary argument against excessive police violence in black communities and attendant laments. I mean, there are things to be upset about here. There are cases. You mentioned some of them. There are others. There is definitely an issue here, and it's really important that it get framed properly. And my piece was actually drafted before this grand jury.
Glenn, can we do something highly irregular? I have a call here from my wife, and I want to make sure it's not an emergency. Let's just keep taping.
Let's not stop.
Martha, what's up?
Let's not stop.
Is it an emergency?
Okay,
bye. Okay, let's keep going.
Okay. Now, I was just in the midst of saying that there's a broad area of agreement between us about this not being a good case around which to try to build a broader argument. Against excess police violence, and also against the larger kind of oppressive dimensions of law enforcement and criminal justice as they impact on black people. This is not a fit case for that. But I want to say a couple of things, maybe even just as preliminary in this conversation. So one is, do we believe the evidence as it's put forward by the grand jury? Now I'm going to say, and by the prosecuting attorney, McCullough, I believe is his name, who gave a press conference last night in which he described the deliberations, the jury's findings, the supporting evidence for it. He described it in great length and he took questions, quite an extraordinary event. Do we believe it? Now, that's a rhetorical question to you. I'm declaring that I believe it. Now, I'm mindful of the fact that in believing it, that's already a kind of political commitment, because it's putting trust in the official organs of government. When the president said, as he did last night, that we are a nation of laws and that the grand jury's judgment is final, implicit in that statement is that we don't go around second-guessing grand juries. We don't go around, I'm going to say conspiracy theory, I don't want anyone to get mad at me. We don't go around imagining hypothetical dynamics for which there may be no evidence that cast those who are trying to present the, quote, facts of the case, close quote, to us in a negative light. I heard Eugene Robinson say on television this morning that while he himself was not a believer in conspiracy theories, he found it curious that the timing of the announcement would be such that It was ideally, that is, announcing the verdict at 9 o'clock in the evening, Eastern time, when it was dark outside and people were given ample opportunity to assemble and therefore to perhaps prepare themselves for violent reaction, that, you know, he said he couldn't help but notice that it had the effect, the violent reaction, of taking attention away from the verdict itself and causing commentators to talk about the reaction to the verdict, suggesting that it could possibly be the case that the timing was chosen with that intention in mind, for which, of course, as far as I know, there's absolutely no evidence. So what I'm doing here by making this as a preliminary statement is saying that necessarily as a kind of epistemological matter. I mean, you know, what are we prepared to believe? Who are we prepared to believe? Okay, so I'm prepared to believe the authorities. Right, I'm just going to make that as a bald declaration. You implicitly made the same declaration when you recounted the quote evidence about what happened pretty much by reading off of the prosecutor's notes from his...
It's interesting. People vary in how they see the world and what they think of as likely, much more than we might think. And I've always had a hard time believing that Darren Wilson would be such a monster / idiot as to get out of his car and start firing his gun at a guy who was running away. I mean, even if he didn't live in a society where there's such a heightened awareness of police brutality against black boys, I can't imagine that that monster would exist, really. And so I'm inclined to believe the authorities in terms of what they found in terms of Michael Brown charging back, because that story is more plausible as something that happens between human beings. But something that I am going to anticipate right now, I can just see the sorts of columns that are going to be written, partly in response to people who are making arguments like ours. There's going to be a comparison to Claudette Colvin, who was a girl who would have been Rosa Parks back in the 50s. But the civil rights movement, the civil rights movement as it was being born, the new civil rights movement at that time, decided not to use her as an example because she turned out to be pregnant by somebody who was not her husband. It was decided that would not be an appropriate person to use as a rallying point, whereas Rosa Parks was
the case.
Now, it's going to be said that people like you and me are claiming that Michael Brown wasn't the perfect victim. And you know something? It's not that I am criticizing him. He certainly didn't deserve to die. But to tell you the truth, depending on what the mores of a society are at the time, there is a case for thinking about Claudette Colvin here. Today, somebody being pregnant by somebody who wasn't their husband would not prevent them from being used as a rallying point for a case.
No, I get the point. If I may, in the interest of time, I mean, the personal discrediting. So there's the larger political claim in the case of segregation. Go to the back of the bus. We're objecting to that. In the case of police violence, shooting down innocent people in the street, we're objecting to that. There's the larger political case. Then there's the character of the individual whose treatment becomes the vehicle for making the larger political case. And a person might say, oh, this reference to Michael Brown robbing a convenience store for some cigarillos.
And then resisting detainment.
Is discrediting in a way that doesn't really speak to the larger political question, and therefore his case shouldn't be put to the side, just in the interest of sanitizing a presentation and so forth. And one can agree or disagree with that, but I think that begs the question. Okay, I mean, I think that fails to engage with what the real issue is here. On the official record, Officer Wilson had heard a radio call to the effect that a robbery had been committed by a person who was of a certain height, who was dressed in a certain way, the
yellow
red cap, the yellow sneakers. I mean, come on, these things are very distinctive. And then he encounters that same person moments later on the streets of the city. Okay, so this is not only or mainly about the character of the individual in question. This is about what the full extent of the situation was. And that takes me to what I think is really the fundamental question here is, there is excessive police violence. Okay, there is an issue about how the police conduct themselves in these communities with these people, especially when they're authorized to use deadly force. There's nothing wrong with objecting to current protocols, practices, and the events that are happening. Those things need to be objected to, and changes need to be made in the way the police conduct themselves. However, the police are conducting themselves vis-a-vis a concrete urban situation. Okay, so to talk about what the police do and don't do without reference to that situation is not to be talking about the problem that's actually confronted. Let me put this a different way. It could be true that we need more dead cops. Okay, I'm not running for office. Okay, so y'all can take that soundbite and do what you want with it. Here's what I mean when I say that. It could be true that the line about police practice, when and where and how they draw and use their weapons, under what circumstances they use force to defend themselves, needs to be moved in the direction of putting them at greater risk in the interest of dealing with the realities on the streets of the cities where the police and low-income black people are encountering each other. That could be true. If that's true, an argument would have to be made for that. If that's true, the relevant policy question here is changing the training, the protocols, the legal framework, and the administrative practices of police departments in the direction of making it less likely that in ambiguous situations they discharge their weapons, and perhaps therefore demonstrably more likely that in those situations they suffer injury. We need to own up to that argument. Okay? Some of these places where the police are discharging their weapons are dangerous places. Where is there any kind of racism in observing that? When I saw Rudy Giuliani, and I'll finish because I know I'm going on too long. When I saw Rudy Giuliani on the Sunday show yesterday, Meet the Press, with Michael Eric Dyson, if you haven't seen it, you should. Dyson is going on in a conventional and predictable way about racist police and so forth. And so Giuliani stops and he says, wait a minute, when I was mayor, I saved more black lives than you will ever save, preaching from your pulpit. Okay? Because I lowered the murder rate in New York City from 2,000 a year to 500 a year. And do you know that 85% of the people, or 90% of them getting rid of, were black and Latino? So we can count the hundreds of lives that I saved with my policy. How many have you saved with your policy? And then Giuliani goes on to say, and I was stunned when I saw it, but Dyson's pusillanimous posture invited this. Giuliani says, the only reason the police are in those communities is because you people are killing each other. Now, that's a racist statement viewed in a certain light, and I get that. I get that. I don't like the idea that I turn on my television and I hear public officials talking in that way. You people are killing each other. That's a horrible thing for him to say and for me to hear say. But, as I say, Dyson invited it. Because, as I say, if you talk about guns on the streets of cities and violence and death and people getting killed, and you don't talk about the situations that are real and compelling in which people are actually getting killed, into which the police officers shoot themselves, you don't deserve to be taken seriously.
Well, there's a devil's advocate here, because to put yourself in the mind of a Dyson, and I think, you know, both of us have read him, I've met him, you know.
With all due respect, I mean, he's my boy.
Yeah, put ourselves in his head. The way he feels is that the reason that, for example, every summer black boys in Chicago start shooting each other over sneakers is because of racism. As far as they're concerned, these boys have no sense of hope in their society. They feel the subtle racist dismissal from white people around them. And then, of course, the idea is that they turn against society and each other because of the way the cops treat them. So as far as Dyson is concerned, still, it's white people's fault. It's America that needs to change. Now, I think you and I both find that to be a weak argument, but that is why, for many people, there is less interest in talking about, for example, why Darren Wilson would have been assigned to be patrolling that neighborhood. Anyway.
Let me just say what I think is weak about that argument. Excuse me, really, just for a minute. Let me say what I think is weak about that argument. It's not weak about that argument to say that these kids don't have hope and that their larger social conditions are implicated in some of the behaviors that are then problematic from a police point of view. That is not, I don't disagree with that. I think that that's accurate. What I disagree with is extrapolating from that general observation about the character and structure of our society to a posture in which you, A, absolve individuals like Michael Brown, whatever he may have done, and may he rest in peace, of what they do, and B, you kind of discredit the forces of authority and order. Presumptively discredited.
Dyson,
and the one doesn't follow
Dyson,
from the
not just him, but in general, a Dyson thinks that a Michael Brown doesn't have any control. Remember that word agency that people like that use? I learned that very early on when I jumped into this kind of debate. The idea is that it's unfair to even suggest that the black community has control in this case. It's considered to be a special case, I think, in human history. The idea is that slavery plus Jim Crow and all these 400 years, then deindustrialization, I suppose, is next, makes it so that we have a group of people who cannot be expected to control themselves. It's on society.
That's a mistake that is a category mistake. It mixes up two different kind of things. Suicides will go up if the unemployment rate stays above a certain level for a certain period of time. Okay, I don't have the data at my fingertips, but I'll bet it's true. Okay, so a social scientist can learn that, and that's worth knowing. This individual who hung herself, you can't account for that action with that reference. That's absurd. That's you know, it's just mixing up two different kind of things. There is no inconsistency between the simultaneous existence of collective and of individual responsibility. Societies are responsible for the conditions in which people live. People are responsible for what they do in those conditions. I see no contradiction.
You know, I know what you mean, but I honestly think that a lot of people, including a great many academics and intellectuals, would disagree with that point. You and I would be considered a little bit backwards. We're supposed to understand that there's a point beyond which individuals really cannot be held responsible. I think that in terms of that suicide example, many people would say, no, you can't talk about what was going on inside of her. It's the larger issue, which is why I think that, as I wrote in my piece, the main flashpoint of Ferguson is that Michael Brown and his friend refused to step aside. And I'm not saying that in blame. I'm saying that because that shows you what their attitude towards law enforcement was. And I think that ultimately that's law enforcement's fault. And that's when I dovetail with your ideas about that aspect of what we need to consider. Now, do I think of Michael Brown as responsible for the fact that he really could have just moved aside? I do, but on the other hand, I also see a society where I don't think that a representative number of people are going to be convinced of that. There are too many Dysons in terms of the intellectuals. There are too many Dysons in terms of the community leaders. The community itself, we're talking about generations deep of people who have an advanced view, which is that there's something larger, that we cannot control this, it's society's fault. We're not going to change their minds, which is why I have such an interest in just getting the police and young black men away from each other as much as possible.
Well, okay, John, there's wisdom in what you said, and certainly the observation about, you know, contempt that police have for people, that people have for police authority and all that being at the core of this. I think there's a lot to that. I want to go, however, stay on this question of agency for just a moment. I agree with you that if we do a head count, it's probably the census will come out, as you predict, with many pundits, commentators, and intellectuals.
And ordinary people.
In a way. And ordinary people just kind of denying that, you know, people have choice of agency or whatever. Here's what I want to say, though. That, you know, there's an ethical question here. I'm getting ready to, you know, wax more or less eloquent about the philosophical dimension. What would it mean to treat people with dignity and with respect? Okay? And withholding from them the presumption of their being responsible and capable in terms of the management of their own lives is a profound move of disrespect, in my opinion. I don't know how you can possibly have equality under such conditions. Those people then become infantile. The people about whom you say, oh my, look at their conditions, they can only do this. They become outside the the orbit of any kind of moral discourse. I mean, they're not moral agents anymore. I mean, this is just very bedrock kind of Kantian stuff.
You gotta treat
people as moral agents, man, or else you're not taking them seriously as human beings.
Well, isn't it sad that the fact is that we're backward? That is exactly why a lot of people hate the things that you and I write, because the idea is that this kind of Kantian, you might even call it enlightened way of looking at it, doesn't work when it comes to the descendants of African slaves in the United States of America. And I think, you know, to the extent that there are people who insist that you are a conservative and I'm a conservative, you know, we renegade black writers, what we have in common is that we bristle under that classification as weak. I can say that that's definitely what one of my issues is. I cannot stand the idea that part of my racial identity is supposed to be that I'm supposed to only pay lip service to the idea that we can do anything about our fate, that I'm supposed to just, you know, watch the steamroller rolling over us and have a sense of, you know, heroicness in undergoing it and making sure that people see me undergoing it. That doesn't work, and I don't think it works for you, and I think that that's true of everybody else I can think of who's one of the quote-unquote bad black writers. It's that we feel denigrated by that position, but that makes us backwards in the eyes of many. And I don't think we can cut through that, unfortunately. I think you and I are united partly in what might be a matter of temperament, but a lot of people are much more comfortable than you and I would be with with thinking of themselves as primarily victims. That's supposed to be the advanced view. We've gotten past Kant. Our dignity is in being acknowledged as powerless. That's what I think a great many very smart black people and fellow travelers think.
Well, you know, the pity is this is ground that's been covered over and over and over again. I mean, I remember James Baldwin in, I don't know, like 1949, 1950, writing an essay. I mean,
that really?
Baldwin, okay, it was before Baldwin became Baldwin. Yeah, it was an essay published in Commentary called Everybody's Protest Novel.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, in which he criticizes Richard Wright for a kind of, you know, move of the sort that we've been just kicking around. But I can also remember Shelby Steele. I mean, I got to give the brothers props on this one, identifying this battle over innocence and guilt and this issue of shame as, you know, really psychological motive factors in the racial discourse, where, you know, everybody, you know, white people don't want to be thought of as racist, black people, you know, want to be thought of as victims, and where behind the scenes lurks this kind of avoidance of reality for fear of shame, right? Black failure, this kind of word, terrible words, we don't use them anymore in polite company, but surely the unwillingness to acknowledge the reality, I mean, the reality of violence in the lives of young African-American men today, okay, the reality of that violence, okay, and it is not mainly police violence. That doesn't excuse police. It doesn't excuse police, okay? I grant you that the police officer's abuse of his authority is a greater crime than the criminal who happens to be in a gang and they're getting revenge and they shoot somebody out the window and some kid gets killed. I grant you that. It's a more serious matter for the society to be focused on and to work toward correcting. But the reality, I mean, you know, Chicago, everybody points to Chicago because of all these murders. I went and did a Google search. I ended up at a Huffington Post archive where they had all of the stories for 2013 about shootings in Chicago. There were like 25 listings on each of 13 different pages. And when you scroll through them, the stories just ultimately kind of just overwhelmed you. You know, I'm just reading a synopsis, just the first paragraph. But I'm getting the sense of, you know, kids sitting on the step, teacher coming out to the car in the parking lot outside of the school, kid was the valedictorian of this, kid was the star athlete of that, kid coming up, you know, on and on and on. 4th of July, holiday weekend, 35 shootings, this is the headline, and this thing, blah, blah, blah. I'll stop. But, you know, does the one cancel out the other? That's not what I'm saying, okay? But I am saying that the milieu, the conditions in which people are functioning, including police officers, need to be seen for what it is. And there's shame in that, okay? There is a kind of, you know, fear of the confirmation of the worst that you imagine to be thought about the group. If you like, Claude Steele, the psychologist, made the concept of stereotype threat famous, and that's in the performance situation of an individual who's in a minority group about whom there are these thoughts that they can't do a particular thing, like do mathematics or whatever, and their performance is undermined by their anticipation that they might, in one way or another, confirm this threat. Well, I think there's a kind of collective psychological threat that lingers over this discourse from the point of view of many African-American intellectuals who are my friends and my colleagues, and we labor in the same vineyard. But if we don't get this one right at this late date, man, we have abdicated our responsibility as critical thinkers,
in my opinion. I know what you mean, and I think, listening to you, I find myself thinking that, ironically, the people who are in a better position to do something different and change the dynamic are the cops. It shouldn't be that way, but think about what we're at this point. We're at a point where the argument is supposed to be not that a black boy should not get shot when he's out buying Skittles and on his way back to his dad's apartment. The new argument is a boy should be able to steal, to assault the owner of the store, to resist being detained when found, to probably engage in a scuffle with the officer, and then, for whatever reason, be coming back at the officer. And even under those conditions, he is not to be shot. Now, I wish he had not been shot. I really wish he weren't dead.
Of course.
But the idea seems to be, no matter what a black boy does, he must not be shot. The idea being that the reason the black boy is doing all those other things is society. There's nothing wrong with any of it. We're not even going to talk about it. What can you expect? Seems to be the idea. And I don't know if we can dissuade people from that. The idea seems to be that what Mike Brown had done before is ordinary. Nobody puts it that way. But the notion is, well, what do you expect? You know, it's an imperfect society, therefore he was no choir boy. It seems that the cops are the ones who are more in a position to change, which is why I tend to focus on it.
I think that is right. That is spot on. I want to just say one thing in slight contrary to what you're just saying. I mean, I don't think people are saying he should never have been shot. I think people are saying, having had the altercation in the car, there would have been a way of handling him coming back that didn't require discharging the weapon 10 times and leaving him with a hole in the top of his head. And as I say, I think what that translates into is that police should take more risk in those ambiguous situations and be less quick to employ deadly force. I think that's what we're asking them to do. And I think the consequence of that, among other things, is going to be that there are going to be more police who find themselves getting into trouble.
Can I ask you?
Okay, and I think that has to just be faced up to if that's what we're saying, and that argument has to be made. There just isn't any way around that. And certainly, declaring that this police officer is some kind of racist demon, he's a Ku Kluxer, or declaring that this kid, on the facts that we seem to know now, is a choir boy, is no way to
get that argument. Let me get this clear, because this is something I've always wondered. I always sincerely wondered why the police aren't more likely to aim at somebody's feet or knees or legs. You know, why does it always have to be through somebody's head or through somebody's chest? Are you saying that Darren Wilson could have done something such that Brown was subdued or would truly run away rather than shoot into him? Because I wonder myself.
Yeah, including giving ground. Darren Wilson could run away. I'm not recommending this. I mean, please understand me. I'm saying, if we were experts, we'd be able to parse this with greater precision, okay? That there will be a range of options of behaviors in a situation in which you're trying to control somebody or deal with somebody.
Where you put yourself at risk as well.
And there will be dimensions along which you can put yourself at more or less risk. I mean, for example, you just mentioned shooting to wound and not to kill. Again, I'm not an expert. My understanding is that the training of police officers is if you pull your weapon and discharge it, the circumstances must be sufficiently grave that there's no point in shooting to wound. If you pull your, this is what I believe, and this can be contradicted by people who know more than me. If you pull your weapon and discharge it, the point is to stop the person. Okay, you can't speculate about having stopped them. Somebody with a bullet in their leg might be coming. So basically, what you'd have to say is that in the set of circumstances in which you were previously authorized to stop this person, that's not going to be a smaller set of circumstances. There are going to be circumstances where heretofore you would have been authorized to stop them, where you don't stop them. Now you can run away, you can back up, you can let them keep coming, you can go to fisticuffs. Mm-hmm. You have options. And the net effect of that is going to be presumably fewer dead people in the position of Michael Brown and more dead people in the position of Darren Wilson. I'm not advocating it, but I'm saying that might be the logical outcome of a certain kind of critique, because we do have, and I also want to emphasize, we do have situations in which these kind of encounters between police and people on the street are going to occur. I also want to agree and underscore your point that the ball is in the police court on this. That you can't possibly expect, you know, ministers of a church to preach, you know, peace to their community in such a way that suddenly a dangerous neighborhood doesn't become dangerous anymore. It's a dangerous neighborhood for deep reasons. But the way the police it is within their control. They're the administrative, they train the officers, they hire them, they compensate them, they advance them or fail to advance them, they decorate them or, you know, put a black mark in their record for the things that they do. And they are responsible for maintaining the trust of most of the people who live in the community. If they raise their revenues by stopping people for petty traffic things, if they're impolite and contemptuous when they deal with people, if they're overtly racially profiling, et cetera, they will destroy the ability to function in the community because it requires cooperation between the police and the community residents in order to function well. So definitely the Ferguson Constabulary, the Ferguson Police Department, helped to create the situation that we've seen unfold here by, for years, the way in which they conducted their affairs, whether that's a violation of federal or anything, I don't know. But I think as just common sense observers, we can say that with some confidence. And the ball is in their court. To engage in a process of reconstruction in the aftermath of all the bad blood, literally and figuratively, that has been spilled.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize what this kind of policing creates, the mindset it creates. They don't realize that this kind of policing creates exactly the kind of mindset that makes them impatient about the black community, and they seem to sometimes think that this mindset just comes out of nowhere. Another version of it that I have noticed this week, actually, is the race story that has suddenly been knocked out of the headlines, I imagine, to the relief of Mr. Coffee. I wrote a...
Yeah, let's do this briefly.
Yeah, I wrote a piece on him the other day where I just, you know, I accepted that, I assumed that these charges were valid, as I think pretty much everybody has. And I found, much to my surprise, that I got shit on Twitter from certain people. And I started looking, kind of connecting the dots and thinking, who exactly are these people who are angry at me for just acknowledging these facts about Cosby and having some things to say about them? And I realized there is a body, apparently, of black men, I imagine women too, but I got it all from men, who actually think that still that Cosby is being set up For them, they think that society wants to tear down a famous black man. And even with all this evidence, they think that it's made up, especially because this is white women who are coming forward. That is the mindset that racism creates. Those men aren't crazy. As far as they're concerned, they live in a society where it could actually be true that Cosby didn't do any of those things. And it's some of that that I think we're going to see with the response to Ferguson. There will be, for many people, no way to look at it other than that Wilson is a monster, that lies are being told, that there are facts that are being suppressed.
It should be said that there are many cases like this. The Rosenbergs. Okay, I mean, these are very distant analogs. Mm-hmm. Okay, I acknowledge that. But I'm only talking now about the extent to which belief is in a partisan environment to some degree structured in predictable ways, regardless of whatever the evidence might be. You know, and distrust and trust in institutions and so forth. Sacco and Vanzetti, you know, various cases that come to mind where movement, you know, the demand for justice in a deep sense comes up against, you know, the conflicted and ambiguous factual circumstance of a particular idiosyncratic occurrence. And we end up with, you know, decades and sometimes generations of argument. I can't forget this scene, and I'm sure you know it, in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, where, you know, he's panning the camera up a Brooklyn street or whatever it is, and there's the graffiti on the wall, Toronto told the truth.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that. So here's Spike Lee years after the apparent exposure of Tawana Brawley, and I can't go into details, people know who it is, they need to look it up. Apparently she didn't tell the truth about what happened to herself, but there was Spike nonetheless declaring that she told the truth. It wasn't necessarily a claim about facts. It was an identity, it was a badge of,
exactly.
It was a fist, you know, a certain movement, a certain historical dynamic and whatnot. But when you start ignoring the facts in the interest of the story, you're in Never Land.
Ultimately you are.
Gotta go, John, sorry about that.
Let's keep watching.
Yeah, it was. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye. Yeah, bye. I'll go right away, please, John.